This week in Retronauts, ask not for who the bell tolls, it tolls for the frog. Hi, everyone, and welcome to episode blank of Retronauts. This week is going to be talking about a Zelda game because that's all anyone's talking about this week. Switch just came out. Oh, but wait, we're not talking about Breath of the Wild because that's not retro at all.
Is this Nintendo Nuts, Jeremy?
Yes.
Burn.
I'm the Nintendo Nazi. That's why I wear a bow tie sometimes.
Jeremy, you are awfully dapper.
I know.
That's telling in these times.
And we're talking about a game based that was inspired by a game about a frog. So,
oh, you're right. Oh, my God.
This is Zelda's journey into the alt-right. It's very
sad. True.
Anyway, no, that's terrible. I apologize for
saying
these
things. Wow, we just turned off half the audience.
Yes.
I'm sorry. I
don't think
up.
So, actually.
They should be on our side.
So, anyway, hi, welcome to Retronauts. I am Jeremy Parrish, hosting this week. With me this week, let's be crazy. Let's go clockwise.
So, it's Henry. Hi, Henry Gilbert. I'm a big Marin fanboy. I don't know. I was trying to think of something else to say. I was not ready to be called on.
Hi, I'm Kat Bailey. I host Axe of the Blood God, and Link's Awakening was my first ever Zelda, and I cannot wait to be talking about it.
Oh, wow. Awesome. I am Bob Mackie, and I know the secrets of the Bucket Mouse.
What?
Do you?
I know the meaning of Bucket Mouse
if you want to know. It's I read really about that too, but I'm going to let you tell the story.
Right now?
No.
Okay.
Well, do you want to go now?
There's no context for this, so no, but I'll tell it eventually. Hold on to your pants, folks.
There's no real context for Bucket.
That's true.
For Bucket Mouse, anyway.
Okay, so listen, when you use the phone in the I think it's like the hint line or whatever. Mm-hmm. You're these phones and you pick them up and sometimes it says yes, it's the Bucket Mouse, and you're like, what the heck does this even mean? Apparently, there was a fishing shop called Bucket Mouth in Kyoto. That's what they would say when they picked up the phone, and that is who the fishing guy is based on in Link's Awakening and in Ocarina of Time. So it's based on a Kyoto fishing store named Bucket Mouth. That is how deep of a reference that is, and it took until like a few years ago for someone to discover
obscure,
that.
Super obscure, yeah.
So that's what the Bucket Mouse is. It's actually Bucket Mouth.
And, right, but the way Japanese is written, like
right.
English words in Japanese are written – It's ambiguous.
And I think it was like Moshi Moshi, it's Bucket Mouse Des or whatever, Bucket
Mouse
Des.
Like, and I'm sure the English localizers are just like, what in God's name? Okay, whatever, Bucket
Mouse.
Yeah,
so now you know, put that in your pocket and show it to no one because you will be outcast from society for knowing the secret of Bucket Mouse.
And that sets the tone for this episode of Retronauts because we are talking about The Legend of Zelda Link's Awakening, which I would go so far as to say is the weirdest and most surreal in the entire Zelda series. I think Bob's probably going to stand up for Majora's Mask.
No, I think this
really?
Game. I think this game established how weird and dark and creepy Zelda could get, and just how I guess just trying to be unexpected and surprising to you. I feel like there's some dark humor in Link to the Past, but this game is just has a very dark and weird sense of humor that I love.
I think Link's Awakening pushed the weirdness as far as it could go, and Majora's Mask almost got there, but still wasn't as weird as Awakening can get.
I was telling my friend the other day that Link to the Past like really established where the series would go from that point on, like the foundational aspect of it. But Link's Awakening established its personality from like that point on. It introduced so many weird things like Elrira, like sitting in his little house or whatever, and like the French accents and like the shopkeeper who would like electrocute you and random like Mario references. Like from that point forward, like I felt like a lot of Link's Awakening's personality carried through into the rest of the series, even if other games weren't as weird.
I was going to say in the general structure, this could be getting ahead of things, but I think it established the structure it would use. I'm sorry. Can I just say this?
Go ahead.
Okay. Where you would have to do a mini challenge to get the thing to access the dungeon where I think it set up that standard, which was in place, I think, until maybe Breath of the Wild. I haven't played it yet, so no one tell me.
It's a mystery.
Yeah. It's like you need the key to the dungeon and getting the key is its own challenge and yeah.
Okay.
I'm done.
That's great. So this is a remarkable game in many ways. I think we'll just jump right into it. It was the first time Zelda had appeared on a handheld system. The Game Boy was like 4 years old at the time this came out in 1993. And it was one of the very first games developed for Game Boy by Nintendo EAD and Shigeru Miyamoto's team. And that's kind of significant because, you know, if you look back at sort of the way the Game Boy developed, it was created by Nintendo R&D 1, you know, by Gunpei Yokoi and Satoru Okada. And most of the games that Nintendo published first party were overseen by Nintendo R&D 1, and that includes Mario games. So Nintendo, you know, R&D 1 was taking these important Nintendo franchises and working on them themselves. But for whatever reason, when it came to Zelda, that was Nintendo EAD, and that wasn't their first game project for Game Boy. We'll talk about that in a little bit. But it was their first major production and one of the very few that they put together. And I don't think there was, you know, prejudice involved or like chauvinism about Game Boy, like, oh, Game Boy is not worth it for us. It's just like kind of how Nintendo's divisions were assigned and the responsibilities they had, because from 1989 through 1993, Nintendo EAD was really heavily invested in the Super NES. And even though they didn't develop the hardware, it was really their responsibility to flesh out that early lineup. I mean, you look at the games that they started working on in 1988 and continue publishing through 1992 or so, and you have Super Mario World, you have Pilot Wings, you have the Nintendo version of SimCity, you have F-Zero, you have ultimately The Legend of Zelda: A Link to the Past. Those are monumental games. Those are massive games. Those are huge undertakings. So EAD was really – they were really caught up and really committed to building a great start for the Super NES. And so that left kind of responsibility and stewardship of the Game Boy to R&D 1 and the people who had designed the hardware in the first place. So, you know, by 1993, EAD could finally start to look sort of afield and not focus entirely on the Super NES. And that's about the time you start to see them make games. And like I said, Link's Awakening was the second game that was really kind of a big EAD project. The first one is a game that has a very close link and actually a direct link to Link's Awakening. Did you see what I did there by mistake? And that was Kairo no Tame ni Kane wa Naru, or For the Frog the Bell Tolls, which is a game that only came out in Japan. And one of the characters from the game shows up in Link's Awakening. And really, like, the technology that they built for this game, the sort of game engine, would end up being used in The Legend of Zelda: Link's Awakening.
I played through this game about four years ago.
You played all the way through it?
All the way to the end. Okay, there's a fan translation.
Like a third of it or so.
It's really interesting. Yeah. Like, the fights are bizarre in that it's like – Either you can beat the enemy or you can't. It's like an auto battle where you approach an enemy and there's like a cloud fight, and then you either beat him or you don't. So a lot of enemies are just roadblocks to get the item, like the weapon you need to pass them. So the encounters aren't at all like Legend of Zelda, but it's a very puzzly, very comedic game, even more so than this. It's like straight up comedy. At one point you visit – I think they call it in the game Nintendo. It's like a game developer, and all the caricatures of the people are working there. And it's not a secret area. It's like a major area of the game going to this video game developer. It's so weird. Like a lot of the silly, like outlandish humor in Link's Awakening is really amped up in this game. And if you can find a way to play it, there is a fan translation. It's easy to find. Please do, especially if you like Link's Awakening. There's a lot to love in this game.
I had not even heard of this game until the star of it was revealed as a Smash Brothers trophy in the Smash Brothers Wii U 3DS. They announced it, and that's how I think was the first time Nintendo of America gave it an official American title, which is the For Whom the Frog Tolls, I believe it is. And now that attack makes sense because the trophy attack is just if it gets on a fighter in Smash Brothers, it then turns into that cloud of action. So
the when we say the engine was kind of reused for the Link's Awakening, I think what people really mean is that this is a sort of Zelda-ish view, even though it has this own kind of separate combat system. It has that kind of top-down three-quarters perspective.
I think it even has the side-scrolling areas too, like when you go into some caves and things, there's ladders. I recall there being that element of it in the game as well. Huh. Yeah.
But, you know, in terms of structure, it has the sort of puzzly adventure element that would really define Link's Awakening and a lot of Zelda games after that. And you saw some of that in A Link to the Past, but not nearly to the degree of Link's Awakening. So yeah, it is really important to understand sort of the origins of this game and have as much to do with, you know, previous Zelda games as they do for the Frog the Bell Tolls. So it's kind of this little forgotten corner of Nintendo history, and I'd love to see them go back someday and provide, you know, an official U.S. release for the game. But I don't think that'll ever happen.
I think that ship has sailed. But
you'll get Mother 3 before that, I would think.
Someone has translated it. It's a good translation, and it's like maybe 5 hours long. It's really fun. It's very slight, but I found it interesting as someone who loves Link's Awakening to play through. And it's always fun to find a Nintendo game you didn't know existed and play it.
And there were a bunch of those on Game Boy. Like a lot of Nintendo's first-party releases on Game Boy were pretty obscure for a long time. Like Donkey Kong 94, I don't think a lot of people knew about. Mole Mania, I don't think a lot of people knew about.
Great, yeah. That was a late release too.
Yeah, and that was another EAD Miyamoto game.
So. Yeah, you know, I never thought of it like that until you just said it now that I think Nintendo really did have their teams really siloed there of just why would EAD, when they're mastering the Super NES, then take time off of working to death on that to learn how to make a Game Boy game when the Super NES needed all the content it could get.
So but at the same time, the Game Boy was 4 years old by that point. And if you think about that, that's quite mature. For context, by like, you know, 4 years – by the time the Game Boy Advance was four years old, the DS had already been out for a year. So I mean this – so it's actually kind of crazy if you think about it that EAD took that long to get over to the Game Boy to actually start making a game.
I guess when you know – that's like saying somebody who lives to be 100, they weren't old when they were 50. It's the same deal with the GameCube. We're like, yeah, 4 years wasn't old. It's gonna be around for like eight more after
this. I mean, the Game Boy like had an absurdly long lifespan. So I mean, it's crazy. It's really crazy if you think about like how long that freaking system actually lasted.
Yeah, I mean, it really started to fade like 1995 or so.
Yeah.
So
but then Pokemon.
Right. But it was still very vital, I think, in 1993. It's still, you know, a lot
happening.
I feel like this was the most ambitious game of up to that point, period. Just nothing had tried to do as much.
On Game Boy,
It was, I think, almost the size of A Link to the Past.
I think the only thing that really compared to it in terms of scope was Final Fantasy Adventure. Which was also a very similar sort of action RPG game, but it didn't have anywhere near as intricate a structure as Link's Awakening.
All the items, all the
Not even that. It's just that, you know, if you look at Final Fantasy Adventure, it's a very straightforward action RPG. You know, progression is pretty simple, pretty like point A to point B, go to this town, you know, learn this magic spell, walk a circle eight around or figure eight around the palm trees. Whereas Link's Awakening is very, very intricate. It's like a Gordian knot of a video game and you're constantly trying to unravel it.
But they both have side quests that revolve around bananas, but one of them is not secretly heroin.
That's Final Fantasy Legend 2,
I keep messing that up.
Okay.
I'm sorry.
That's okay.
It's actually telling that when this game was, you know, in its heyday in like, you know, 93, 94 – the fact that people were comparing it directly to Link to the Past, and it was a legitimate argument whether Link to the Past or Link's Awakening was better, and it was really a preference thing.
And then, it is a technological marvel that they could pull that off too on like a Game Boy is so simple. Like an original Game Boy is such a simple machine as compared to the Super NES, and then they were able to also get all that with just – a D-pad and four buttons, and no shoulder buttons.
It blew my mind back in 1993 because it was like, you know, you start with the actual opening cutscene, right? And you cut to the shot of Link, like this beautiful art of Link hanging from the ship in the middle of the storm or whatever. And that looked like something that I might have seen on like a Super Nintendo, at least in my mind. It was really remarkable. And the art was really vital. It was really strong. Like everything had so much detail to it. The music was really, really, really good. And the technological limitations did not really occur to me. Like it was, as you said, a technological marvel.
Yeah, going back and playing through this game, I find myself surprised by some of the stuff it does on Game Boy. Like if you bump into graves enough, you know, you bump into a grave and a Poe comes out. But if you bump into them enough, eventually there's a like a giant Poe. I'm like, how did they manage to make a sprite that big fly around on Game Boy?
The bosses are really big too and often have lots of moving parts to them too.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I remember the commercial had the giant Poe flying around and I was going, whoa, that looks amazing.
Yeah, so it's really just a true feat on Game Boy and by far one of the most advanced, most sophisticated and best designed games ever to appear on the platform. Mm-hmm.
And how many of the key Link to the Past people were involved in this? It is a Takashi Tezuka game?
You know, I didn't look up the dev team.
I got the answer.
Okay, Henry's here for us.
This is something people don't maybe realize in the pre-Aonuma era with – before he became the series director of it, that the Mario team and the Zelda team were the same team or at least the same heads of it. Like Miyamoto had it. He was in charge and Takeshi Tezuka was the director of it. He was the director of this game and the director of Link to the Past. And also Koizumi worked on it as well, who would go on to run 3D Mario games. And I forget the name of it, but the director of Retro Now, Bob, that you interviewed.
Oh, Tanabe.
Tanabe. He was also big in the scenario creation for that as well. Mm. So you've got those three like highest level EAD people working on it. You guys should just read the Iwata Ask. It's the history of portable Zeldas. They did it for Spirit Tracks and they talked to Koizumi and Takada. Koizumi and Tezuka as well as Aonuma kind of weighing in on it. And they spend the most time talking about Link's Awakening, obviously. And they talk about how that they finished Link to the Past. They thought, could we make a Link to the Past for Game Boy? Let's try it out. And it became an after-hours project. It was not an approved project, which they also credited to why they got to do things that if it was an approved project that went through the right systems, people would have told them, you can't do that. You can't include this character. You didn't license this from HAL. And so it was a lot of that. And also that they got to be weird because they were just trying something out to see if they could even do it. And once they figured out they could, then they got approval to fully make it. But originally, it was just like, could we build Link to the Past in here? Oh, we kind of can. Let's do something special with that then.
So it's the Mega Man 2 of Zelda.
Yes, it totally is.
I like that.
That's a good way to put it. And also that they confirmed in that interview, but I'd read it elsewhere, that like Twin Peaks was a big part of it too.
Okay. Yeah. That was what I keep wanting to say, but I wanted to let this conversation kind of take its natural course. So thank you for getting us to this point. Twin Peaks has been stated as an influence on this game. I have never seen Twin Peaks. So
that's surprising.
Someone else take it away.
Well, I watched the first season of Twin Peaks, which I guess is the only season you should watch. I watched it after playing Deadly Premonition to be like, what did they take for – oh, they took everything. So I watched Twin Peaks. It's great. Obviously, you don't need me to tell you that. But I don't see any direct links. But I think what Tezuka said, that he wanted a game full of mysterious characters with unclear motivations. So you're going to meet a lot of people who are weirdos and you're not sure if they want to help you or hurt you. And that's sort of what Twin Peaks is all about. Like, who are these people? Why are they so weird? What are they up to? Like, that's sort of what –
why is there a tiny
about.
Female chain chop jumping around with a bow on her head?
Exactly. And like –
she wants makeup.
Just like how Detective What's-His-Face ends up in Twin Peaks. Link is in this weird place full of weirdos and he needs to get out of it.
Talking animals.
A stranger in town in a weird place that feels somewhat familiar and somewhat not.
Yeah.
And there's some secret that he has to get to. But because this is a complete game instead of a TV series, David Lynch can quit after the first season. This actually has a beginning, middle, and end. If you hadn't heard of Twin Peaks, it was prestige TV before that was a thing.
Mm. Yeah, this movie guy is going to make a TV show. Yeah. And he's edgy.
David Lynch, who at that point was really famous for Blue Velvet and making like edgy R-rated films, is going to make a drama for television.
Like if you watch Eraserhead and then be like, want to watch this guy's TV show? Most people would say no. I don't want to see this. In fact, never show it to me.
But it was the hot thing in 1990 or 91. Like The Simpsons, it was a contemporary of when The Simpsons was super hot, which tells you how old that show is.
Yeah.
And clearly it had an effect in Japan. Like it carried over to Japan very well, at least to developers of games, because like they all were watching it. Like they admitted in the article that they're like, yeah, we were all watching Twin Peaks, but they don't like get too much into it. They don't say like, well, I watched this episode of Twin Peaks or whatever. It just seemed to be a thing they were watching at the time. And they're like, oh, this is a good jumping off point. But it's not – there's no murder mystery in it. Like it's not really about that, though maybe you kill everyone by waking up. I mean, if you mentioned Deadly Premonition, but also Alan Wake, like, is the most like slobbering deep kiss to Twin Peaks there ever was, I'd say. And it's a fine game, but yeah. So that's really where Twin Peaks comes in there, and it also really ties it to the early 90s too.
Yeah, and the game does have a lot of sort of dream logic to it, which makes sense because it's a dream.
This game is
20 years old.
Like, why is Mario here? What's going on? Why is Yoshi here? Like, why are Goombas here? I think those touches are not just for fun. It's to make you feel uneasy.
But it's not even – yeah, I mean, there's that. But just the people you interact with.
Yeah.
Like, in this game, I can't think of any other Zelda game where you talk to an alligator who's obsessed with bananas food.
Canned food, that's right.
That hippo there are characters from other games.
Yeah.
Dr. Wright, who is, of course, Will Wright, taken from the Super NES version of SimCity.
And he's being catfished by a hippo in the animal village. He's like, I'm actually a woman. Here's my picture. And it's a picture of Princess Peach, which is actually in the original game. It's not one of those extra DX cutscenes.
Wow. Yeah, but her name is Christine.
Yeah,
not Princess Peach.
Right, Christine. I forgot about that.
So that's what that was. Like, I haven't made it to that part in my replay.
Yeah, so he's like a pen pal with her and in love with her, and she sends him a picture, but it's a picture of Princess Peach. But when you go visit her, she's like a hippo or a rhino or something like that in the animal village. It is weird.
Link's guide is an owl who comes down and like is giving him lots of guidance. And
that would become a thing in Zelda.
Yeah, exactly. Originally in Link's Awakening, that would have been kind of an odd thing. It wasn't this owl's talking to me, and we associate owls with sleep and nighttime and that kind of thing. But then, of course, in Ocarina of Time, and actually quite a few things from Link's Awakening kind of transferred over to Ocarina of Time. The music being a major theme, for example. The huge, huge fetch quest that like had multiple connections.
Yeah. Fishing?
They call that the straw
trade chain.
They call it straw millionaire because that was in the Iwata's too. But that is a Japanese fable that they all refer to. Like, oh yeah, the straw millionaire, the guy who had a piece of straw that then traded it so many times that he eventually ended up being a millionaire.
You've just explained every element of Japanese game design.
That's exactly it.
In RPGs, at least.
This is a cultural thing that they've all heard of, and it's why they put it in – it's why it's core to so many games.
The owl stuck around.
Yeah.
Still in Ocarina.
Yeah, as did Marin and Malin. I mean, Marin is obviously Mario. Who Ingo is he in this game too?
No, like, he's not.
There's some Luigi corollary in this game who lives in the mountains.
But the mean,
he's not evil. He's just a Luigi looking guy.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, they would have Mario and Luigi in this game, and
Yoshi
is a toy.
Kirby,
Wart. Kirby as an enemy. Yeah, Wart as a. I don't think
he's an NPC. You talk
to. Yeah, he's an NPC.
Does he teach you the mambo or whatever?
I believe he is one of the music guys. Yeah, but it's just the sprite. Like they just took the sprite from USA and put it in there. They draw him differently. They draw him Zelda style in the instruction manual, but it's just his sprite from Super Mario 2.
That's a great sprite.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Let's talk about the story to the game. I mean, there's not that much to talk about, but I think it is an important place to kind of begin to understand the game. It does begin in a different way than any other Zelda game. It begins like an East game, actually. Mm. Link, you know, is in a storm and he is shipwrecked and he washes up on the shore and a girl finds him and takes him back to, you know, care for him. And he wakes up and there's a girl and her father kind of like watching over him. That's totally like every East game. That's Link has become Adol Kristen. Mm-hmm. And that's actually kind of where the game starts to get a little, you know, like, hey, this isn't the typical Zelda thing. You're not just like setting out on an adventure, but rather you were already on an adventure and you've been waylaid. Like, who knows what Link's actual adventure was in this game? Yeah, it doesn't really – like it gives a little bit of, you know, like he's off to find new lands or something.
This has to be in the timeline, right?
Oh, yeah.
It is. It's actually like, before the split.
It's well, yeah, but where they placed it in the timeline now, it's right after Link to the Past. He has completed his mission in Link to the Past and is just off to do whatever he's going to do now that he saved the world. And he gets waylaid during that.
Interesting. Right. Okay.
So he washes up on this mysterious island and –
Koholint?
Koholint, yeah. And basically he's on this island and has no way off. And so this owl comes up and is like, yo, Link, if you would like to get off this island, you need to wake up the windfish. And so his mission then becomes to wake the windfish, which he does by finding 8 mystical weapons, each of which – or weapons.
Instruments.
8 mystical instruments. Sorry, I was still thinking Final Fantasy V.
Gilgamesh.
Which – yeah. Which you know, are located in dungeons all around the island. And once he has these spirit instruments, then he goes up to the windfish's egg because, of course, fish sleep in eggs at the top of a mountain.
Yoshi
Why
eggs.
Not?
Yeah, it's a very Yoshi-looking
egg. It's a green-spotted egg.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's just a big old egg that's sitting there, and it looks like it's kind of like Death Mountain, but it's not really Death Mountain.
Right.
But also, interestingly –
it's also an easy trek up to the top. There's no, like, Lionels or anything like that.
There's one ladder.
Yeah, you just go up the ladder.
But it's also reminiscent of Ganon's Pyramid from Link to the Past, where you're like – you know, you're standing at the top and then at the end of the game, it breaks open and now you can go inside.
So we're talking about the beginning of the game. I think like Majora's Mask, it throws you a curveball and that Majora's Mask disempowers you by making you play as a Deku for like 3 hours. But this game, you don't get a sword until you play maybe 20 minutes, 15 minutes.
It's actually
– you just walk down to the beach and you go get it.
But you have to fight enemies with just a shield. You have to like shove them out of the way.
Well,
and stuff.
You know where that – well, I got to it in like 5 minutes, but I was like, well, yeah, I know where the sword is.
Yeah.
Like, I didn't spend 20 minutes walking around the town talking to everybody.
Oh, I did.
But that's
– I thought it was a cool choice though. You have to find your sword. You just get the shield.
Yep.
Go have fun.
But when you get the sword, it's not the like the master sword that's like able to shoot things.
Right.
And also they – right from the beginning, they're adding like lots of little interesting things, like their guardian acorns that will power up your defense.
Yeah, I'm not
and stuff
a fan
like
of
that.
Those because they change the music, and I don't like the music.
And the Triforce power ups,
the little chunk of Triforce.
So those are interesting. When I was streaming this for Nintendo last week, I realized like they're called pieces of power, and they look like Triforce, but
they're not Triforce.
The Triforce of power is Ganon's Triforce piece. So what does that mean?
I wonder.
That's really strange.
I mean, I do it's like, all in the dream. So what does that mean, like metaphorically for him? What is why does
right?
The dream
Am I the villain? Are we the baddies?
I don't like the music changing. I like that sketch, by the way. I don't like the music changing, but I like when you get the Triforce piece or power piece. It knocks enemies across the screen.
Yeah, I do
it's
like
really
that.
Fun.
It's very satisfying. Yeah. And enemies who normally take 2 hits go flying and die in 1 hit.
Also, the first time you get the sword is really great because Link holds it up, you know, as he does. And then after the triumphal theme is complete, he does the spin attack and like everybody on the screen dies.
You know, another curveball that the game throws is, you know, you mentioned that you don't start out with a sword. You just have the shield.
Right.
The shield is different. Instead of just like walking around and automatically blocking things, you have to hold up the shield to defend with it. Mm-hmm. But because of that, it changes the dynamic of the shield. So instead of just blocking projectiles, now the shield can be used to push things. You can use it to actually physically block enemies from hitting you. And on top of that, you can actually push them. Like invincible enemies, you can push into pits. And like it literally opens up some new possibilities. The shield is no longer just this passive element that you're carrying.
Mm-hmm. And they want you to learn that real fast.
Yeah.
You know, like.
Yeah. I mean you have to push with the shield to get those spiky things out of the way to get to the sword.
I mean,
and you don't have to equip a sword or a shield or a sword. Like all of a sudden everything in your inventory becomes optional and the game starts to to play with combinations of equipment and tools and – Yeah, like it's not your typical Zelda in that sense.
Yeah. I mean, there are a lot of items with a lot of different utility, and I feel like they do it very well, but it does get kind of annoying when it's like, okay, there's a long jump here. I got to go to the item screen, equip the rock feather and the Pegasus boots, do the jump, then equip what I was using before. I mean, the menus, that you can just slide right in and out of them, but there's a lot of going to that menu to change items.
My only problem with the menus is that I always want to hit B to exit out of a menu. But if you hit B,
that assigns that
item to the B button. But I really think that the reason that they did this wasn't – I mean, maybe I'm just speculating. I am just speculating. Maybe I'm totally wrong. But I feel like they went from a game on a system with a controller that had four face buttons and two shoulder buttons to a system that has two face buttons. And so you could no longer have a game quite as complex as A Link to the Past. So instead of being able to equip a bunch of stuff all at once and have different buttons assigned to those abilities, you know, that was taken away. So they stopped and said, well, what if you could actually unassign things like the sword? What if the A button wasn't always a sword attack? What if now the A button was the rock's feather to allow you to jump? Or what if it, you know, is a magic rod or something like that? And so while it doesn't involve some, you know, some menu juggling, it really does change up the possibilities of what you can do in the game and how you can equip yourself. And it's unique in the Zelda series in that way.
Yeah, the fact that you don't always have a sword is really interesting.
Yeah, I would think that would impact their design to a degree of just them thinking about, well, does the player have a sword? I don't know if they do in this moment.
Yeah.
They might have to switch out to it. They won't always have a sword at hand.
One more thing about items. I'm sure there's more, but you have this down here. The boomerang I thought was really cool because it's an optional item, but you have to decide what item you want to get rid of to squeeze it into your inventory. And I think it costs like 400 rupees or something. Maybe it's high price. I forget.
You can also, in addition to that, you can trade away your sword to get the boomerang, which is a bad idea, but you can do it if you want. Like they really do have to account for the fact that maybe you don't have a sword. Maybe – you know, you've traded away your boomerang. All the strategy guides say, give them the shovel. Use the shovel for the boomerang because after you've dug up all the stuff that's hidden in the world, you don't need the shovel anymore. But you don't have to do that. If you want to like go around and dig up every single damn thing on the screen, go for it.
Can you block your way like from being able to complete the game? Like could you theoretically give them an item that you actually need?
No, because you can trade back for the original item. So if
this
you need
not
the
a Sierra
sword,
game.
Yeah, you can't screw yourself
it's
over.
It's not Return of the Zork.
You can just inconvenience yourself.
I gotcha.
It's not like that. But in addition to the ability to switch out weapons and not necessarily equip a sword or a shield at all times, Link's Awakening was also really unique in terms of its structure. And, you know, it has eight dungeons and there's a boss at the end of each dungeon and all the dungeons have tools inside that you need to use to beat the boss. Like it takes that element from Link's Awakening or from A Link to the Past. Like that has, you know, it's kind of canonized here as this is how Zelda games will work. But to me, Link's Awakening is really interesting and really unique in the Zelda series in that pretty much every dungeon you get to involves basically a puzzle just to get to the dungeon. And there's certainly elements of that in subsequent Zelda games, but it's much more prominent here. Like every single dungeon, just the process of getting to that dungeon is really challenging. Some of them are locked with keys. Some of them, like, you know, there's a moat or something that you have to cross somehow or something. There's always something that's in the way. And sometimes the straw millionaire comes into that, the trading chain.
Yeah.
And sometimes you just need to, you know, go find a plot item or something like that. But it's always very involved and you can't just go like, oh, I'm done with that dungeon. I'm going to go to the next. You have to stop and take stock and really explore and talk to the NPCs and poke around at every screen. And I think part of that comes from the fact that this being a Game Boy game, it is a smaller world than the one in A Link to the Past. And there's only one world as opposed to A Link to the Past, which had parallel worlds, two worlds. Because of that, they had to do more within that space. And so it becomes much more of a complex, multi-layered puzzle just to navigate the world.
I was going to say that you're absolutely right. I think that's why they did that, so that it didn't, you know, suffer quite as much as in comparison with, say, Link to the Past. But you were saying, like, those puzzles really are involved. Like, for example, there's one that's actually – you could constitute as a mini dungeon where you're going and getting the five golden leaves.
Oh,
and there's actually a mini boss that you have to fight. it was a surprisingly big world, all things considered. And there were, if I recall correctly, 8 full dungeons on top of that, mm-hmm. which put it in line with the original Zelda. I think the original Zelda also had the
– Yeah, 8 dungeons. Well, plus Death Mountain.
Plus – yeah, Death Mountain.
Yeah,
so.
I think like the Zelda dungeon, in my opinion, is the ideal form of gaming, the gaming experience. Just like it has everything I like in a perfect container. Mm-hmm. And I love A Link to the Past dungeons, but I feel like Link's Awakening dungeons are more refined and more thorough. Mm-hmm. Going back to Link to the Past, it's like this is still like one of the best games ever. But some of the dungeons are kind of slight. Some don't develop their ideas enough. But Link's Awakening really has really developed ideas, like a thesis to every dungeon almost. And I feel like they improve on so much. Like just hearing a chime – to know there's a key in a room is such a great improvement. And also, I think every dungeon has a mini boss as well as a regular boss.
Most of them do.
Yeah. So that's something that they added as well. There were no mini bosses.
Stalfos is a mini boss, for example. Actually, it's funny. Like I mentioned earlier that Link's Awakening was my very first Zelda. I mean, of course, I had played Zelda before. Like I had played the original, but, you know, not very much. Like I don't think I had even gone to a dungeon at that point. Like I knew of Zelda as a thing that was very popular. And I started playing Link's Awakening and I got to my first dungeon and I did not understand the language of the design. I did not understand that progression meant sometimes you push a block and the door opens. Sometimes you got to kill everything in the room. Sometimes you have to light all of the 4 things to be able to continue. Like stuff that was just second nature to people who had been playing Zelda to that point. Like I was literally calling the Nintendo helpline to be like, what do I do? And they're like, push the block. And I'm like, oh, great. Well, that's another $40 on my phone bill.
Yeah, it hadn't rewired your brain for Zelda thought yet. And this one was a good training for that. I had a similar thing too of like that I played Zelda. I played Legend of Zelda and Legend of Zelda 2, but I was, you know, 7 or 8 and I just – my brain wasn't ready for it. I think I've even said it on this podcast before, but of just that my idea of a game was Mega Man, Mario, Zelda – or Mega Man, Mario, Castlevania of just I'm on this side of the screen. I want to get to that side of the screen. Like the idea of a top-down, it just confused me so much. And so I never really got much of anywhere in those two games. When I rented them, I didn't even buy them. And so, yeah, and that's – I also didn't get A Link to the Past when it first came out, probably because I was just thinking like Zelda, whatever that is. Those games made no sense to me. And then Link's Awakening finally was the one that got me.
It got me in because it felt like a much more – you know, it was a story. Like it was a much more straightforward adventure than, say, the original Zelda where like, you know, it's just like wander, go do things. And like a lot of people – you know, I know that Jeremy finds that extremely exciting and a lot of people do. And now I'm playing Breath of the Wild. I'm like, wow, this is like amazing. I love like just wandering around and everything. Yeah. But certainly at the time, I really appreciated just the greater structure to Link's Awakening.
Yeah, like you guys, I mean, I dabbled in the first 2 Zelda games. I was too young. But I think in 1992, something in my brain unlocked that allowed me to play RPGs in Zelda. And that's when I really got into A Link to the Past. But because I bought this with my own money and I had a Game Boy, Link's Awakening, I played this probably, I don't know, 20 times through. Just as a kid, it was like one of the 5 games I owned. Mm-hmm. So I would just play it over and over and over again. So I have so much of this game just etched into my brain. But I have a really strong attachment to this game for sure.
I would glitch the 8th dungeon. Like there was some kind of glitch that would let you get to the item. So for the longest time, I did not know how to properly beat it because I did not know the actual puzzle. I only knew how to do the glitch that would get me onto the top of a wall and then I would jump down and I would go and get it.
Wow. Yeah. No, I played this quite a lot over a summer or two. I think I probably played of this same – around the same time. I played Donkey Kong 94 more than this. Mm. But this was my – this was the first Zelda I could just – take my time in. I think it also was the first Zelda I owned. So maybe that's too – when I was playing Zelda 1 and 2 as rentals, I was just like, well, I got to speed through this. It's got to go back to pick and save next Monday.
And this was back when there were only, what, 4 Zeldas? I mean 1, yes, 2, Link to the Past, Link's Awakening. So like a new Zelda was like a big deal, right? Yeah. Like Ocarina of Time was the next one after this. So, I mean, we didn't exactly have a lot of Zelda to choose from at the time.
Yeah, in 5 years, you get another one. But I just remember this game is so etched in my mind. I remember buying it at the software, et cetera, I would later work at, which still exists and has never changed their carpet. And going to McDonald's, I went there in last August, and they still have the same filthy carpet, by the way.
Wow.
And I went to McDonald's after with my mom, and I remember eating chicken nuggets, looking at the instruction book, going, oh, my God, a new Zelda. Oh, look at – oh, and there's an owl.
The manual's so greasy.
Yes. I was fastidious then, Jeremy.
Oh, okay.
I was wiping my hands down.
That's
but, but yeah, but I just I don't know why it just hit me at the right time, and I got to replay it so much, and I guess I didn't mind it being green and fuzzy. You know?
This is the game that I bought a Super Game Boy for. I never owned a Game Boy originally, and sometimes friends would let me borrow their Game Boys, and so I played, you know, Gargoyle's Quest and Tetris and Metroid 2 even. Like, I played all the way through those games on someone else's Game Boy. Sometimes my brother would let me borrow his, not very often. But this game, you know, came along and I didn't really have access to a Game Boy, and I was like, I'm going to need more time with this one. So, you know, the Super Game Boy came out like the next year and I bought it, and this was the game that I bought for Super Game Boy and played through it.
I played a lot of this on Super Game Boy years later, and then I beat it like five more times. So it was good. It had no special border though or anything. It was made before.
No, it was before that. Yeah. It had a custom or like a built-in palette assignment, but that was pretty much it.
Yeah.
But yeah, I've never actually played this on original Game Boy hardware. I've played it on Super Game Boy. I've played it on Game Boy Color in the remake.
You probably don't want to.
No, probably not.
Yeah. I had my old vacuum tube
Game
Boy.
Played it on 3DS.
Vacuum tube.
Vacuum tube Game Boy without the battery cover.
Yeah, you lose that battery.
The hand-cranked one.
Yes.
Children lose that battery cover too easily. Like,
yeah.
But yeah, it didn't look fuzzy to me. Only when I saw a Game Boy Pocket was like, oh, the regular Game Boy looks like crap.
The thing was that at that time, I had a Game Boy and I could play on like on a PC or something. Mm-hmm. I did not have a Super Nintendo. I would not get one for years. And I really, you know, it was a point where I kind of had to use my imagination. And like when I was looking at these games, I was not thinking in terms of graphical fidelity. I was thinking, wow, this game looks really good for a Game Boy game. Mm. Like I was picking out kind of the positive details rather than focusing on the negative. Mm. So yeah, no, of course it didn't look as good as Link to the Past, but I'm like going, wow, look at all that really detailed art. Look at like that really complicated animation. Look at how big these bosses are. This is really impressive.
And as a Game Gear owner at that point, I knew like I shouldn't even care that this isn't color, because then it'll eat all my batteries.
Six AA batteries for an hour.
The worst. The worst. I think too, design wise, you think about that they had to make all these traditional Zelda things without having color to indicate anything. Like they couldn't specialize things with a color. So, like, well, this item, they had to redraw an item or give it a slightly different shade of puke than if they wanted to make this. No, this is the blue wand versus the red wand.
Like the crystal ball switch. Like I didn't even realize that those were crystal balls in the original game because they were just like this monochrome thing. I thought that I was hitting like this little guy in like a cloak. That's what it always looks like to me.
So somewhere between A Link to the Past and Link's Awakening, Link washed the pink out of his hair. Is that in the timeline as well? Mm-hmm. Because his hair is no longer pink.
Yeah, he finally got out of his punk phase.
Nintendo are pink hair deniers, even though like,
I hate that.
Pink, its hair is pink right there.
It's pink for the entire game. And then when you beat that game, he's such a disgusting range of colors. Like, it's purple and yellow and red and orange and pink.
I remember when Link Between Worlds was announced, I asked Bill Trinan, like, hey, why isn't his hair pink? He's like, Zelda's hair – or Link's hair was never pink.
That never happened.
I don't know why you guys are talking about
that. Then he put a rag over your mouth and dragged you away.
No, that happened when I asked about a Mother 3 port after. He really wasn't happy to hear that question.
All right. So one of the things I really love about this game is the way it combines elements of so many other games, including some of the early Zelda games. Like, Bob, you mentioned the Goomba passages. So one of the kind of odd quirks of this game is that when you go into underground passages beneath dungeons or even into caves, it becomes a side-scroller.
Mm-hmm.
And, like, it works like a Mario game, up to and including the fact that there are Goombas and you can jump on them and squish them.
And if you jump on Goombas, you always get a heart.
Yep. Yep.
So, okay.
Which is just ridiculous. Like, why is that in Zelda? But you know, if you look back, if you look back at the original The Legend of Zelda, when you go into the passages underneath a dungeon to get weapons or just like to move to another part of the dungeon, they do have this kind of like a change in perspective where it's side-scrolling. And then, of course, Zelda 2 was a side-scroller. But now you've got you have a top-down Zelda game that has proper side-scrolling capabilities. Like well, it doesn't actually scroll, but you know, the, like the side-scrolling mechanics, the platformer mechanics, where you can jump thanks to the rock's feathers. I feel like they really, you know, the new things that they put into this game, they really stopped and said, like, how can we make the game even more Zelda? Like, how can we follow up on crazy ideas from the past and explore them to the full extent? And so you have, you know, Link doing the Mario and squishing things, and there's piranha plants coming out of pipes.
Swimming around Cheep Cheeps, things like that.
It's bonkers.
And Link being able to jump is a fairly rare thing, like, for the most part. Like, Link's jumps have always
been. Up until just now.
Not anymore. Now we're in the world of Link jumping.
I mean,
Sexy Link jumping around.
Link's jumps have always been so limited for the most part. Like, not always, but for the most part. So to have an actual item where he would be able to jump and that have that be a large part of the puzzles was really interesting. Like, I always had that feather equipped. Like, I never equipped a shield.
The rock's feather is basically to the Zelda series what the feather in Super Mario Kart is to that series.
That's
like,
true.
It showed up once.
The rock's feather.
Well, actually, no. It did show up in one of the Oracle's games. But
that's
about it. But, yeah, they just recycled the
game. Yeah, that's because Oracle was just half of this game. and then they made a really cool thing with that. But it started with this. Yeah, I mean, by the next game, Ocarina would just be like, go to an edge of a thing and you will jump, but we're not giving you a button for it.
All this talk makes me sad that Zelda cannot be this weird again because, I think people take Zelda way too seriously. And I mainly talk about the timeline, but it's like, no, this is a serious adventure and it's epic.
But it's
about a beautiful man who does amazing things. And it's like, but it can be weird. I like the weird stuff.
But every Zelda has like that weird thing. Like the weird shop owner is like,
I feel like now it's just like a little drop of weirdness.
I don't know.
Wind Waker was probably the kind of resurgence of this sort of weirdness, but it's still stuck to Zelda style rules, I think.
Yeah, I mean, they really went over the top with like Skyward Sword's villagers, actually. Especially if you look at Hyrule Historia. Like you see the sort of the iterative processes that helped them come up with the final villagers in Skyward Sword, and you're just like, man, they were really spitballing in this one. and there's plenty of kind of wacky goofiness in Breath of the Wild that I've seen so far, which is not that much.
Right.
Yeah, there's I'll refer back to that Iwata Asks again that Aonuma is in it too, and he credits Link's Awakening for giving them permission to be weird, as the saying goes, that they said if Link to the Past was the last Zelda game before they made Ocarina, Ocarina would have been very different because they had the permission to get weird because they could just say, well, Awakening was weird, so we can have these other weird moments in there. And also because they really love Link's Awakening on the team, so they wanted to emulate that.
I just feel that there are unspoken rules, like Link cannot appear anywhere else. That they broke that with Mario Kart 8, though.
Yep.
And also nothing can appear in a Link game that is not from Hyrule or from the series. I feel like there's an unspoken rule, but Mario Kart 8 was like, okay, we need to sell Wii U's. We need to sell Mario Kart. Here's Link. Here's a Link course.
That Mario Kart 8 moment was like, I don't know. It felt wrong to me.
Yeah.
It's like, oh, really? You're going to – yeah.
I was talking to somebody and they were like – well, Hyrule Course is in Mario Kart 8. And I was like, oh, what? Is Link going to drive around? I'm like, yes, on a horse motorcycle.
Yep.
And they were like, what?
It's a fun stage. It's good.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Nothing ruins anything now. There's no like, this ruined my childhood. Like that is a bullshit thing to say. But it was like a moment – it crossed a line you can't uncross.
You feel like –
well, now he's here. Like even more so than – Breath of the Wild has a season pass? How dare they?
Yeah.
They sold out. Like, they already sold out. Like, he was in Mario Kart.
It's over. Link was in Smash Brothers from the very start, and it did not.
Fighting each other.
But it made total sense to me that Link would be fighting Samus, and I was like, oh, great. Now I can finally find out who's going to win, Link or Samus.
Yes.
But I feel like if Link were to touch Mario in Mario Kart 8, they'd just time cop each other and melt because they're not allowed to occupy the same space.
I love
time cop is a verb, by the way.
I love that some of the kind of like odd or out of place elements in this game went on to sort of sow the seeds for not just Zelda games but other games. Like if you look at the Chain Chomp, you know, in Super Mario Brothers 3, you had Chain Chomps, but they were just kind of like these static objects that would sort of defend a small space. And occasionally you got into an area where they kind of moved around freely. But here you have Chain Chomps more as like a pet. And
that thing is so empowering.
Getting away from you is – or getting away from its post is a huge story element. And to me, that reminds me of Super Mario 64 in the first stage where you have to like free the Chain Chomp while it's trying to hurt you. And that, you know, once it's free, then it bounds away and it breaks a gate, and all of a sudden you get access to a star that you needed to collect. And on top of that, like the idea of a Chain Chomp as a pet shows up again in the most recent Paper Mario game, Color Splash.
Oh, really?
Where there's an entire section like around an archaeological excavation where you're like trying to track down this, you know, this escaped pet Chain Chomp, and it's not that hard to, you know, kind of see where it's been because it makes a mess of the scenery, like tears up the paper and the cardboard everywhere. Mm-hmm. But like that is straight out of Link's Awakening.
Yeah,
personified Chain Chomps more than they had way more than they had been in Super Mario 3. Like they were an enemy like any other. And I think you get a little more hint of their personality in their appearances in Yoshi's Island, but 64 is really where they become a thing.
And you know, the kind of legend behind Chain Chomps is that they were designed because Shigeru Miyamoto was like deathly afraid of this chained up dog when he was a kid. So I kind of wonder if the fact that a big part of this game early on involves you carrying around a Chain Chomp as a pet is like trolling Miyamoto or something.
They're just like, alive.
Hey, check this out, Shigeru. Look what we did.
And the dog in there.
And the Chain Chomp can do a lot. Like aside, more than like you can take it to the monkey, and like the monkey and the dog will fight.
Right. And if you take it to Richard's villa, he's like, "Get that thing out of here." There's like, there's variable dialogue if you're carrying that thing around.
Yeah. The writing in it is they didn't have to do any of that. Like they didn't have to put that work in there. Nobody expected. Lots of dialogue from a Zelda game at that point.
We should take a break soon, but when you take Marin to the animal village, when you get her in your party, you lift her up like you're like you got an item, and then she yells at you if you go into people's drawers and stuff, and she chastises you for things, and you can fall on her and she'll yell at you. So I love all that little incidental dialogue that they didn't need to put in.
But can we just really talk about the fact that if you can steal in this game, and not only if you steal from there, you can never go in the shop again because he will kill you.
Yeah.
And not only that, but it'll change your name to Thief. And everybody will call you Thief from that point on. Like,
but really, they did that again in Twilight Princess, right?
I don't remember.
I don't know. But I think like the only thing you need to buy in this game is the bow, right? It's what the entire world's economy is based around in Link's Awakening. The bow costs 1,000 rupees, and that's all you can carry. And that's basically the one thing you need to buy, I think.
You have to buy it because you need it for the final boss.
Oh, yeah, that too.
But yeah, one thing that I didn't even realize when I started replaying it is that you can go and buy bombs at the very beginning of the game. Like I kept walking around waiting to find bombs, and I finally an enemy dropped a bomb, and I was like, yes. And then I went back, you know, an hour later to the village and went to the shop because I was going to buy a shovel, and there's bombs. 10 rupees for 10 bombs. I'm like, what? They're giving these away. I'm such an idiot. Like,
Twilight Princess would make you wait 8 hours for those bombs. And you'd like it.
I feel like more recent Zeldas actually do like actually have the bombs in the shop that you can just buy, and now you got them.
Well, Breath of the Wild is very unprecious about bombs.
Yeah.
Well, they literally give them to you for like you don't run out of them. You can just like set them and you can remotely detonate them. It's so great.
What a future to be.
I could be playing this right now, you guys.
I know. We should be playing this game. Let's take a break and go play some Zelda.
Woohoo!
And caller number 9 for $1 million. Rita, complete this quote. Life is like a box of
chocolates.
Rita, you're cutting out. We need your answer.
Life is like a box of chocolates.
Oh, sorry. That's not what we were looking for. On to caller number 10.
Oh,
Bad network got you glitched out of luck? Switch to Boost Mobile's super reliable, super fast nationwide network and get four lines, each with unlimited gigs for just $100 a month. Plus, get four free phones. Boost makes it easy to switch. Switching makes it easy to save.
Hey, it's John Horn here. I'm the host of the new podcast that you need to subscribe to right now. It's called Geffen Playhouse Unscripted. And every week I chat about the creative process with stars who have roots and ties to theater. Who so far, would you ask? Well, let me tell you, we have Rainn Wilson, Neil Patrick Harris, Josh Gad, Dana Delany, Bryan Cranston, David Copperfield, Matt Walsh, and so many more yet to come. It's called Geffen Playhouse Unscripted with me, John Horn. You can download it on the Podcast One app, or you can subscribe now on iTunes or at podcastone.com.
Hey everybody, Bob here, and you might be wondering why a guy who gave up driving 5 years ago has any business at all reading an ad for something like TrueCar. Well, I know firsthand all the baggage that comes from owning a car, the insurance, the maintenance, gas money, and choosing the perfect bumper sticker to sum up your complex belief systems. And before all that, there's figuring out which car to buy in the first place. So if you're in the market for a new ride, consider turning to TrueCar. With TrueCar, you can see what other people in your local market paid for the car you want. Information that empowers you to feel confident. Once you register with TrueCar, you can connect with a certified local dealer and see real pricing on actual inventory. And with over 13,000 certified TrueCar dealers nationwide and over 3 million cars sold by TrueCar dealers, you can rest assured that TrueCar has a history of happy customers. Customers who, on average, save $3,000 off the MSRP. So when you're ready to buy, visit TrueCar to enjoy a more confident car buying experience. Some features are not available in all states.
So let me tell you the craziest thing about Link's Awakening. There's no Ganon in this game. There's like little pig dudes you fight. And there's the little piece of power, but there's no Ganon.
Isn't one of the versions of Nightmare, the final boss, like a shadow of Ganon or like a
image of Ganon? It's not really Ganon.
I mean,
it's your illusion of
Ganon. Right, but I mean there's a tiny bit of him, but not really.
A little bit, yeah. But not that really counts. He's dead. He's gone. He's been taken away from this reality.
That is also what they wanted, a clean slate. They talk about that too in the interview, that they really – they didn't want to worry about all that stuff. They didn't want to think about making a new story in Hyrule with Zelda and Ganon there. It's like, no, we need a little corner we can paint in ourselves.
I think that's why it is a dream, just because this really doesn't matter to whatever Zelda story that's being told. Own thing.
That's a very Japanese game design thing that way predates Awakening. Of just like, this is a Gaiden. It doesn't count.
Yeah.
Like, this is – if something counts, this doesn't count. So our boss won't be mad that we change something that counts in it. And a dream is always the way, or a dumb time travel thing at the end.
Yeah.
Some other reset button hit to make all your progress not really happen.
Phantom Hourglass is also a dream. It's an entire dream.
Yeah, I really don't like that. As somebody who grew up on comic books and wanting everything to count all the time and want to catalog where everything in Spider-Man ever happened and why it all must matter, it is a knee-jerk reaction I have. Just like, oh, so you told me a story that doesn't even matter. I can't carry this information to another game. Like, F off.
Truth be told, like Ganon, I mean, Ganon's fine. I suppose he's like a good villain and everything. But I mean, I actually find a lot of the villains in a lot of the other Zelda games like more interesting. Like the bird. I like the bird in Wind Waker. I like the Lord of the Twilight Realm who was working with Ganon in Twilight Princess.
The one in Skyward Sword was dumb though.
Yeah.
It's like their gender is ambiguous. Isn't that scary?
I'm saying.
Yeah, you know, I actually thought he was okay. Like he's not my favorite, but he was like a good test most of the time.
Well,
so
I like that Ganondorf got to have the like personality that Ganon never got to have.
Ganon doesn't have a personality anymore.
He's just an evil pig man.
I mean, you just look at Link to Between Worlds, like Ganon's like, oh, and I guess you got to fight Ganon at the end. It's the same as Spirit Tracks.
Yeah, and also the Oracle's games.
Yeah.
I mean, that's just pretty standard.
I was kind of surprised to see on the back of Breath of the Wild, like help Link fight Calamity Ganon or whatever. Like they just flat out tell you, Ganon's in the game.
Yeah, like there's no secret. When you wake up, it's like, oh, check it out. There's Calamity Ganon.
But I think it's a way just to reassure people because they want that to be part of Zelda.
But if Link's Awakening came out today, like I guarantee that you would have fought the shadow things and then it would have been like, oh, and look, Ganon's here.
I was the one who wrecked your ship. It was me.
Yeah, I was always a little disappointed that Wind Waker did such a good job of giving Ganon a personality and giving him, you know, even some gravitas. Like in the final battle when you stab his face, he's like – he's kind of wistful about having become evil. And and then, you know, they're like, OK, well, time to go find a new Hyrule. I thought, oh, this is going to be a clean slate. Future Zelda games are going to be different. But no, future Zelda games take place in the old Hyrule and they come up with a ridiculous timeline convolution so that you can keep fighting Ganon. And it's kind of interesting, but also like I wonder how much more interesting Breath of the Wild might be if you weren't going to go fight Ganon and didn't have Princess Zelda in there somewhere. I mean, it's The Legend of Zelda, so I guess you've got to.
Go ahead.
Well, that's why Awakening is so special because they just are like, no, we don't gotta. We don't have to. We will have a character that looks like Zelda and we will have things that like call back to it, but we don't have to do any of this stuff.
Mm-hmm. In the meantime, Link's fighting kind of his own like the nightmares of the past, right? Mm-hmm. Like the final boss, like I said, it's basically a boss rush and enemies that you have fought in the past start to appear like – I think one of them is actually a Ganon where like it's shooting the orb. And I hadn't played Link to the Past at that point. So that was where I totally learned how to like do that and stuff like that. And, you know, they were kind of recycling boss designs. But whatever. Like thematically it was appropriate.
Mm-hmm. I forgive it. It's just to get some more stuff in there. I forgive repeating boss designs.
There were a lot of cool bosses in this game. I remember like the genie, you have to pick up his bottle and throw it.
That was a good one.
This guy who like keeps shoving this log at you from like back and forth across the room. You have to jump over the log and hit him. And there's like a lot of really cool ideas. There's two bosses per dungeon. Mm-hmm. So they have to have a lot of ideas to make them interesting.
Yeah, you fight the mini boss usually right before the main boss and it gives you the warp back to the beginning of the dungeon.
Which is another advancement on Link to the Past dungeons, that shortcut. I don't think there was any kind of shortcut kind of thing in Link to the Past.
Talking about the bosses in the Eagle's Tower, we were talking about side-scrolling and stuff like that. That is actually a side-scrolling battle that takes place in Link's Awakening.
That's right.
Because you have to climb to the top of the tower and you have to actually like jump over him when he's attacking and – it's actually a really hard boss battle.
It's pretty tough.
Because he keeps knocking you off the top of the tower and you have to kind of get back up to him. And I think the fight resets if I recall correctly. I'm not sure. But I remember that fight really kicked my ass in a lot of respects.
This game in general is very tough. Mm-hmm. I think it's because you collect fewer hearts throughout the game. And the enemies don't hit any less hard than in other games.
And you don't have like four bottles or anything like that you did. Are there any – I forget if there's any sort of health item you carry around.
So you can go talk to Crazy Tracy. She's like, hey, big guy, I'm going to rub you down. And that'll give you one resurrection. But every time you go, it becomes more expensive. So you can't really abuse that.
So you can't break out the bottles like you can in other Zeldas.
Yeah, and you know when you beat a mini boss and get the warp, you always get a fairy, which actually looks more like a flying worm, kind of weird. But yeah, like it definitely is less lenient than other Zelda games. Mm-hmm. It's just as tough as any other Zelda, but it doesn't give you as many advantages in a lot of ways. So it can be pretty tough. I've died a lot more playing this game in this replay than I do in other Zelda games.
Yeah, I'm dying all the time in Breath of the Wild.
That's different.
Seem like the hardest Zelda game to date, at least in a long time. I'm just seeing death gifs on Twitter of people dying in interesting ways in the game.
I just got set on fire by a laser statue, so yeah.
You got to watch out for those guys. But enough about that. Anyway, but the Link's Awakening – It was really hard. I was surprised how hard it was as a kid. And also that I wonder how much their design depended on the – like how much they thought about it being a portable game in the design of it. Like did they make dungeon – they structure dungeons differently and your ability to save and the that fast travel within the dungeons thinking about – no, someone turned off their Game Boy and is coming back to it or their mom told them you have to do homework now. Put that away.
It has like an instant save feature, right? Yeah. Like hold and start and select.
Hold all the buttons.
Yeah, and it saves automatically the last doorway I think you enter. Yeah, so
that's right.
Yeah, it does work around that.
I forgot those kids tell you that right at the beginning and they're like, I don't know why I said that.
Yeah.
I love those kids.
Yeah, so. They're great. Like I'm just a kid. I don't know why I know this.
Yeah, yeah, another thing. I think this is the only Zelda game that has a narrator. Like it tells you a lot about what Link is thinking. So like when you come out of the first dungeon and those kids are freaking out and they're just like rambling about how Chomp Chomp or Bow Wow or whatever was kidnapped, they go on for a while and then it's like dot, 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 dot. They're kind of rambling. So maybe it's faster just for you to go have a look around yourself. and you see a lot of that. Like it's kind of, you know, like someone's talking to you about the adventure. Someone's telling you about it. They're narrating.
There's little comical asides. Like you can look at every dresser or whatever, but there's nothing
in
it.
Wow, that's
like
a nice chest.
Yeah, just like there's no – I mean that's – I guess it's a joke, but there's nothing to it. You don't find anything. It's just like, wow, this is nice. Like that's basically it.
But,
and yeah.
But as always, the comedy – accentuates the sadness and, of course, at the end of the game.
I was just going to say like the fact that this game is a dream, like that's normally a cheap cop-out. But in this case, it's more poignant.
Yeah, you become much more attached to all of the characters. Like you get to – because it's such a small island, you're not roaming around all of Hyrule. You get to know everybody really well because characters like Taran like are – kind of wandering around like the entire game. Like there's the whole bit with the beehive, for example.
All right. He's shrooming.
Yes, exactly. When you go to the animal village and you see Marin singing the song for the first time and it's a really nice song. And then, of course, when that music is playing at the end and everything's fading away, like it actually does give me goosebumps.
Speaking of music, whenever you find those instruments, I always found it interesting. Like this Game Boy made them sound similar to what they're supposed to be. I mean, they're a little off because it is a Game Boy sound chip or whatever, but they're pretty convincing, and that always surprised me. Like replaying it again, like wow, that really sounds like the whatever.
Yeah, absolutely, yeah. You have like the drums, and you have the. The harp and everything.
You're running around with an entire pipe organ in a backpack. Sure, why not?
But there's like a moment the first time you discover that is actually a dream because you have to go through a dungeon and there are like some dark nuts that you have to fight. Mm-hmm. And then you finally illuminate the cave painting and you see the windfish there and the owl. And then you realize at that moment that it is in fact all a dream. And it becomes a question of do you wake up? Do you remove this like this island? Do you effectively like consign it to memory? And it's a moment actually. Yeah. Like and then of course the first time – you go into the final dungeon and it's really dark and you can feel the shadows kind of pressing around you in a way that's actually really remarkable for a Game Boy game.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think this might have been me and my brother were playing it at the same time as kids and I think he caught it first and said, I think he's asleep the whole time. Like, oh, it was all a dream. It's going to end with it was all a dream. And you know, now we talked about Tanabe working on this.
Oh, you're right.
Super Mario Brothers USA. There you go. That's another – he's into that.
Well, he likes that trope. He watched a lot of Roseanne, I guess.
I don't think they were that sly about it because I'm pretty sure a character's like, what if we're all in a dream? Well, anyway, later.
I mean they probably weren't if like 11-year-olds were saying, I think it's all a dream. Like it was probably projected very easily, obviously. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So let's see. Some other things to talk about before we kind of wrap this up. The hidden seashells. I feel like those are – I can't decide if they're like a nod or a troll toward everyone who got the shovel in A Link to the Past and was like, I have to dig everywhere. I want to see what's out there. because here is a game where you can actually dig up places and find something hidden.
As a kid without the internet or like GameFAQs, I found all the seashells, and I feel like when you have to dig from them, it's pretty obvious where you do.
Yeah, and you can also carry Bow Wow around, and he'll freak out whenever you come onto a screen has a hidden seashell.
But when you go to that house, the seashell house, you just walk in and a meter fills up a little bit, and it's like maybe if you collect enough seashells, something good will happen. And it's like what am I even doing this for? You have no idea what the goal is at first.
And then it turns out that's the only good sword in the game.
Yeah.
If you turn in all the seashells. Well, so it's worth doing.
What does that sword do? Just hits for more damage?
Yeah, doesn't it shoot a beam also?
It's been a long
time. It's like a
Well, the two things on this. First of all, it's pretty true to the whole original Zelda, bomb every wall, burn every bush. But also, like, collectibles just became more and more of a thing as we got more and more to more Zeldas. Like, for example, in Twilight Princess, getting all the bugs. Ocarina of Time had a ton of stuff to collect.
Skulltulas.
Yes, exactly. So having seashells kind of reflected the trend of the series, I think.
That was way more reasonable than skulltulas. It's like, well, they're only out at a certain time of the day, and good luck finding them all.
Yeah, and then Breath of the Wild has the Korok acorns or whatever.
Korok seeds,
and
yep.
Supposedly there's like 900 of those in the game
Dear
or something.
God. Oh, my
Lord. I don't know how there can be that many, but I've stumbled upon so many without even looking for them, but you just come to an area that like, oh, one of these things is not like the other. Maybe if I move this rock and then a dude pops up like, oh, okay, hey. I did one where I rolled a rock off of a perch, but then nothing happened. And I was like, I guess I'll just go. And I like take about 12 steps and then it cuts to a Korok saying like, hey, you found me. Here's your Korok. So I was like, oh, I guess I did something. Yay.
I spent a lot of time looking for pieces of heart in that game in Link's Awakening, and it was a point of pride to get all of them. And I think that might be the first time that I really felt a lot of pride in collecting all of the things in a video game.
And that's where it began.
Yes.
It's hard to be a completionist with this game, though. One thing that always annoyed me was I don't know, maybe a fifth of the map is this river rafting minigame. And in order to uncolor every colored in block of the map, you need to hit every one of those like little pieces of river. And it's hard to figure that out. Like you have to be strategic, and I can never do it. Hmm. I could do it, but that was just too much time.
So we touched on this a little bit, but I really feel like we'd be remiss if we didn't talk about like just what a role music actually plays in this game and how that really informed so much of what came after that. Like aside from the fact that you're collecting all eight of the instruments, you also get the ocarina. And we were talking about whether or not it was like a flute or actually an ocarina of Link to the Past. But in Link to the Past, if I recall correctly, there's a story beat about it and then you use it to summon I always thought it was a duck. But that flies you around.
It's very duck-like.
It is very duck-like, yeah. But in Link's Awakening, like you can get three different songs from a big fish guy named Mambo. And interestingly enough, I think Shovel Knight actually tipped a hat to that because they have the Truple Pond where you can go and get your fishing rod and it'll do a little dance for you and everything.
So it is localized as flute in Link to the Past, but it is literally the blue ocarina, like the exact same thing. So it's not a flute.
So – and of course you are playing a duet with Marin with the song because she teaches you the Ballad of the Windfish and you have to use it to awaken the windfish at the end of the game. And then that of course carries on into Ocarina of Time as your primary means of transporting through time. And then you had the like the baton and Wind Waker and in Spirit Tracks you had the flute that you actually blew. So like – that just became such a major thing and that really owes a lot to Link's Awakening.
I believe in Ocarina of Time, thinking back to our episode about that, they were going to make the Ocarina system much like this where you select from a menu. But Miyamoto was like, no, playing this is fun. Let's make the players play it every time. So I feel like that was something that they were more thoughtful about, or maybe Miyamoto was more involved in that game. Hmm. So, I mean, Miyamoto, did he touch this at all? I mean,
he talks about it. He was really just like, okay, like he was very busy with other things.
Oh yeah, for sure.
But he definitely approved things. But I think that's also why they were able to sneak in stuff. He probably would have told them, "Don't put Mario in here." Like, hey, that Yoshi that. There's a Yoshi plush in this? What are you doing?
I love when you get the Yoshi plush. It says, he sure is popping up in a lot of places these days, yes. Commenting on Yoshi mania.
Yoshi cookie. Like stuff like Yoshi's cookie was definitely coming out by that time.
Yeah, Mario Kart. Like, yeah, he's in a lot of stuff.
He was
right
definitely
now.
Their new guy. But I want to talk about DX because that was
– That is
we
the final point
that.
To hit. Yes.
Yeah.
So go for it.
Oh, okay. Well, I didn't
– Fast forward to 1999.
I didn't play DX until just now. Like, that
really?
Was the version I was replaying.
Same here. 2013 is when I played it.
Because I didn't rebuy it in my house.
You owned a Game Boy Color, right?
My brother owned a Game Boy Color. I owned a Game Boy Pocket.
Because that was the game to buy when the Game Boy Color came out.
It really was. So, yeah, the Game Boy, as we hinted to earlier, the Game Boy outlived its usefulness, but the Virtual Boy didn't replace it. So they had to have something. Pokemon reinvigorated it. Mm-hmm. And so they're like, well, we could finally have colors on this thing.
So many people bought a Game Boy Color just to play Pokemon, which hilariously, Pokemon was not compatible with it. But then,
well, compatible,
silver,
but it didn't have any.
Right. It didn't have any
features.
Colors, right?
Right.
But then, of course, Link's Awakening DX came out. And oh my God, like playing that game in color for the first time was like revelatory.
Yeah, that was the second Game Boy game that Nintendo gave a color overhaul to.
Yeah.
The first was Wario Land 2. But the difference is that Wario Land 2 came out like 6 months before the Game Boy Color. So it was pretty much just a like, well, let's just take this game that we just made and, you know, beef it up for color. And it didn't really add that much in terms of, you know, content. It was just more colorful. Well, but Link's Awakening did, you know, it added color, but it also added content.
I should add that I have my original cartridge still of Link's Awakening DX. But it has it was compatible with the Game Boy printer, mm-hmm. and you could go around and you could get pictures taken of you, and you had this really cool little like Zelda art. So if you were a fan of Zelda, like that was really cool, mm-hmm. Even if you didn't have the printer, just being able to go around and do the little photo thing.
So what is it with the weird Nintendo games and mm-hmm. photographers who capture your journey? Because that's straight
right.
out of Earthbound. Like it's like Earthbound, the next step. Now you can print out these photos of your trip.
I don't know. Maybe they think a serious photography, especially when you're on a vacation, photography is kind of, or when you're on a trip is kind of a trope with Japanese stuff.
Like yeah, that was like the stereotype in the
80s. I don't want to say it's
yeah.
yeah, that was the American stereotype.
Yeah, like, those
well,
Japanese
you know,
tourists have their cameras
yeah,
or whatever.
Do you, how do you know this Asian, these stereotypical Asians in this comedy, in this 80s comedy are supposed to be Japanese? Well, they have 8 cameras around their neck.
Yeah, yeah.
So, I mean, maybe that those come from the same place. I feel like I'm making a broad generalization over
you know,
people that aren't me.
I watched the second Jurassic Park movie, what was it? The Lost World.
Oh, God.
I watched that with some Japanese exchange students. And when it gets to the end and you see like the Japanese tourist all photographing
the
T-Rex
yeah.
and I was like, oh, my God. But they were all like, yeah, yeah. So I was like, well, okay. Like, I guess that's not some kind of demeaning stereotype after all.
I forgot he used that stereotype as late as 1997.
Yeah.
It felt like a real thing from the 80s.
Yeah. It was very directly a Godzilla reference, not even making fun of the Japanese, but saying like this. I mean, they also are running from it. They run from the T-Rex. And that was the jump the shark moment yeah. of Jurassic Park. Where the gymnastics
well, yeah,
come before
thank
that.
You.
Yeah. Yes, yeah.
So Link's Awakening, I was looking through the notes. I had totally forgotten that there even was a color-specific dungeon.
Yeah.
And now it's all coming back to me. But is that a mandatory dungeon or is it optional?
It's optional.
Okay.
Yeah, my replay hasn't gotten that far in. But I
remember
it being
really
extremely
garish.
Slight.
It's not very good. Did Tosei make this remake?
I don't think so.
Okay, because the color dungeon is optional. And when
but it does kind of remind you of Metal Gear Solid's Color Dungeon.
A little bit, yeah.
yeah. And that was a Tosei game.
Yeah. It was?
Yeah.
Okay, I forgot about that.
Yeah,
so
Tosei developed that.
When you finish that dungeon, I think you either can choose between a colored shield or a colored sword. It's like one item or the other. One is red, one is blue. One gives you more attack, one gives you more defense. But I forget what the actual rewards are. But it's completely optional. It's just like, do you want this extra item? But it's nowhere near the level of quality as the other dungeons in the game.
Well, and Link's Awakening DX is the one that is bound to be remembered by everybody because that is the one that you can get on the 3DS eShop.
Yep.
And I own it. I have not opened it since, but, you know, like I keep looking – I often look at it and think, I should play this again. This mm-hmm. is such a good game. I really love it.
I had completely forgot I even bought it. It's one of those – I go through my multiple folders of old games on my 3DS like, oh, yeah, I bought that. I bought that too. Like the only one I played to completion that I purchased on there was Donkey Kong 94.
Mm.
But,
I think we've pretty much had our say about this game.
Can I point out the only thing that I'm ambivalent about?
Okay.
Making the big, what we were calling it, the straw millionaire quest, making that mandatory. I don't know, because there are, a lot of the time it works really well with the main quest and like slots in neatly. But there are other times when it feels like you're going on like kind of like way off the beaten path. And also like, I mean, some of those things are really not intuitive. Like you have to go around and ask everybody like, what the heck do I do with this thing? And it doesn't – it's not clear that this thing is mandatory. So at the very end, like you like can go into the windfish's egg and like you're in this dark area. You don't know what to – where to go, and you don't realize that you have to get the stupid magnifying glass to look at the stupid library book that – and you get the magnifying glass by doing the huge quest. So that was like
– I don't know how I figured it out then as a kid. Maybe just
– I looked at a guide.
Having played Link to the Past.
It was very guiding.
Did you really not do it without a guide? I had to guide it as well.
I finished it without a guide, yeah. Yeah.
But like making it – making that – the Straw Millionaire quest – like optional and Ocarina of Time to get the big Goron sword was, I think, the correct move.
Mm-hmm. And, you know, them making DX, that was the other thing I want to mention. Them making DX, that I think if they hadn't redone it, I don't think the Capcom games would have happened, because I think redoing it made them say, well, we could make another Zelda Game Boy game, but they weren't – like they didn't want to do it themselves. It's still shocking to think that they let – I mean, it's portable. It's not a console Zelda game, but still letting a Zelda game be made by non-Nintendo people is a big change, even though the people they got at Capcom, AAA developers, and they are also – it sounded like from more of that interview I read that – Capcom was on a short leash. They were not – they couldn't do whatever they felt like with Zelda.
Those are incredibly good games though.
And so good.
Super, super ambitious. Still, I guess, using the Link's Awakening engine or at least assets.
Much,
but like Seasons is like – every screen potentially has four seasons of environment to it and it just makes so many cool puzzles.
We'll hit those in their own episode because they definitely deserve it.
Yeah, please don't ignore those.
But yeah, so to wrap up, I'd like to spend we got so many letters about this that I cannot I would be remiss not to read some of them.
It holds a special place in a lot of people's hearts.
It does. So I'm going to give it like 10 minutes and we're going to see how many letters we can work through in 10 minutes.
All right.
So from Doug Welker, Link's Awakening DX is a game I've only recently played in part because I needed a Zelda fix while waiting for Breath of the Wild. I was blown away. It's amazing how great it looks and how smoothly it plays. While I've never played it on a standard Game Boy proper, my recent jaunt through the game on my new 3DS looks astounding. It's amazing how emotive and full of life the game is. But when you look at it with the limitations of the original system, it's sort of mind-blowing how they pulled this off. I think you'd be hard-pressed to find something doing more with less than Link's Awakening. Michael Staub says, Link's Awakening is such a cool offshoot of the Zelda series. I preferred the era where there was no timeline and Nintendo could have fun making interesting stuff.
Yeah. I'm on your side, bro.
Link's Awakening was definitely one of those games where Nintendo gave us something somewhat unique. Most interesting was how Nintendo added platforming elements to the series with items like Rock's Feather. I'll always be thrown off a little bit by the Super Mario rooms in Link's Awakening, but the game is so self-referential for Nintendo that it's a bit refreshing. Stephen Constantine, or Constantine... Link's Awakening was the first time a story in a video game touched me. I first played it when I was 5 years old. Armed with a handful of Nintendo Power tips and a child's brain, the adventure took me months to complete. The strange inhabitants and sometimes unsettling atmosphere made me feel as uncomfortable as Link must have felt being marooned on a strange island. Realizing what the windfish was and what fighting it meant, it was very emotional for me to see the game through to the end. By the time the credits rolled, I had a very good understanding of the word bittersweet.
Wow, at 5.
I know, right?
That's impressive.
I was like 15. Yeah. And it took me months.
I was figuring out Super Mario Brothers at age 5.
From Nate Lynch. Hey there, Retronauts. Link's Awakening was my first Zelda, and I still regularly replay it, usually once every year or so. It's got my favorite 2D Zelda mechanics. The sword feels better in this game than any other 2D Zelda due to the angle at which Link swings it.
Hmm.
It's hard to describe, but the arc of the swing, starting on Link's right side, parallel to his midsection, to directly in front of him, ending there on his left side, just feels right.
It totally does. Yeah. It's like that arc really works well for being able to take out a lot of different enemies.
I love Link to the Past, but its sword mechanics always felt slightly wonky to me. And don't get me started on the first Zelda's sword going straight out in front of Link only. Anyway, I love that Nintendo doubled down on the puzzle-centric dungeons that started in Link to the Past, making the puzzles pretty much the entire point of the dungeons. In fact, I think the dungeon design is some of the best in the series, besides Turtle Rock with those stupid block-pushing puzzles where you have to cover up lava or pits, which just get tedious as you move from room to room. Eagle's Tower is not an easy dungeon, but I remember figuring it out when I was 8 years old and feeling like a genius. It was probably the most complex puzzle I had solved in my life by that point.
Eagle's Tower, for my money, is probably one of the best Zelda dungeons ever made. It has the complex, like, abstract thinking that is required that you find in the Water Temple in Ocarina of Time, but it's not tedious.
But Oracle of Ages, like, complicates it almost too much. It's just like these are – that those dungeons were way too complex for me, and I had to game fack a couple of them.
There's definitely a happy medium to be struck there, and while I did in fact use guides to beat a lot of Link's Awakening's dungeons the first time, I felt like for the most part I really respect the design sense that went into Eagle's Tower's designs, because I mean – up to that point, like thinking about like stuff like removing the pillars to make the levels come down,
yeah,
and everything.
And having to carry the ball around, and
yeah.
It has its own rules as to where it can and can't go. Really cool.
So from Jonathan Weinhold, what I always remembered about Link's Awakening was how it was the first game to really expand on the formula laid out by the original Legend of Zelda. Link's Awakening expanded on the idea of the side quest so far beyond what Link to the Past did with things like hunting golden leaves or tending to Bow Wow or finding Marin by the beach. This game put life into characters in a Zelda game like no other game before had, and it was the Game Boy that expanded the Zelda formula this much, not the NES or Super NES.
Completely true.
Mm-hmm. From Brian Easton, as someone whose only tattoo is that of a Triforce, it's fairly ironic that my absolute favorite Zelda game is Link's Awakening, a game that doesn't feature the Triforce at all, unless you count those little pieces of power. With cameos by Chain Chomps and Yoshi dolls, and is that Mario moonlighting as Terran? Link's Awakening doesn't take itself too seriously. Yet despite the goofy facade, Link's Awakening is one of the more touching games in the series. For all their winking nods, the characters, especially Marin, feel like they have lives of their own, making finishing the game even more bittersweet. There's that word again.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's a good point, because in Hyrule, in Link to the Past, you get a feeling of like these people don't do anything until I talk to them and then they go away. Like they don't – there's no implication that they're living their lives other than their service of you.
Yeah.
Well, here's the difference between Link's Awakening and Link to the Past. At the end of Link to the Past, you are restoring everything because you are bringing like your dad back – dad, uncle, whatever, uncle. Back to life. Things like that. You see everybody like living happily. It's all great. In Link's Awakening, you make them go away. They're gone.
Mm-hmm. Except – or is it a dream because a bird flies away and it could be Marin. Who knows at the end?
You're literally sitting on a log and you're awake. It's not like you're asleep and you watch the island disappear. And I always thought, what? What's going on here? So was he literally dreaming or was this some kind of illusion? I don't know.
You'll never know.
I think you get a better ending with zero deaths though. Something extra happens at the end.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
I'm pretty sure.
I think when it gets to the end, like something happens.
Yeah. Sorry for being so vague, but someone can look that up. I have two bits of trivia if we're done with letters. Or
we're not.
Okay.
We got a lot of letters.
Let me spit this out whenever you're done.
There were so many letters. I know. I'm barely touching the surface
people
here.
People feel like –
I mean, look at this one from Andrew Osborne. My God. I'm not writing that.
Let's tell people write in 100 words. I appreciate the passion. But,
no, I'm just taking excerpts.
Okay.
All of these have just been like partial reads.
Okay.
From Andrew Osborne. I love the melancholy soundtrack, which holds up surprisingly well. After conquering a dungeon, Link received a musical instrument instead of a Triforce, and the victory music would prominently feature the latest instrument.
Yeah.
When played together to finally wake the windfish, the music sounds especially beautiful and makes for an unforgettable and emotional ending. The game, especially the first playthrough, was difficult in a good way. The secret seashells were hard to find, the trading sequence baffling, and the second boss, the genie, cost me many frustrating lives. The book hidden in the library needed the Pegasus boots to knock it off. I still remember my surprise at this detail. The puzzles were tricky and when solved, felt satisfying in a way never quite matched since. J.C. King says, the game had a whimsicality and dreamlike quality that the series, up until that point, sorely lacked. The stakes weren't anywhere near as high. No princesses to save or evil shape-shifting wizards to defeat. Just an open-ended stroll with sword in hand through a world of comic characters. The dungeon puzzles were challenging without being unfair. The graphics and gameplay were impressive, especially considering the decidedly low-powered Game Boy hardware versus the Super NES Zelda game, which preceded it. the best mechanics from A Link to the Past, such as the dash and spin attack, as well as novel moves such as jumping and active use of the shield, made Link's Awakening a game that kept you beckoning to spend just a few more minutes or hours trying new things. Flying rooster plus boomerang equals spinning hover deck.
Oh, I forgot about the flying rooster.
Arrows plus bombs equals a rocket-powered grenade, etc.
Exploding bombs. Oh, exploding arrows. That was such a cool find.
That was really neat. It was a cool little gimmick.
So the answer to the zero deaths question is if you beat the game with zero deaths, both in the original version and the DX version, after the credits, you will see a picture of Marin in the sky and she's saying, thank you. That is the little extra thing you get. And it seems to imply that her life does go on.
And she became a seagull.
Yeah. Well, you see the seagull in the regular ending, but in this one, after the credits, you see.
How very anime.
It looks like her senior picture.
So Juan Gutierrez says, I've always preferred portable gaming over consoles since the Game Boy was introduced. So I always tend to favor portable games. The Legend of Zelda Link's Awakening was the third Zelda game that I ever played. Until now, it is still my second favorite game of the series, above A Link to the Past, among others. I can't forget to emphasize the musical aspect. Frankly, I think it has a better musical style and selection than many other Zelda games. There is Mambo's Mambo, the Owl's Theme, Richard's Villa, Totaka's Song, Southern Face Shrine, and of course, the many depictions of the Ballad of the Windfish, a very melancholic melody. A very important part of why Ballad of the Windfish is so relevant is because how entrenched it is with the story of the game. Far more important than in any other melody in a Zelda game. Hmm. All right.
Telltale Heights is another great song from Link's Awakening. I think I hear that one remixed a lot.
It was the first time that it was the first game to kind of really acknowledge that the music in Zelda had always really been kind of catchy and good.
And there was always an instrument in Zelda.
Yeah.
But it was always just like not played for any musical reasons, really.
So it kind of became part of the series' DNA from Link's Awakening on.
It's also an interesting thing that like Awakening with the music, that Awakening until Majora's Mask was the last game to have the field theme. Like it's not in Ocarina, and so it was a big deal that it got put back in Majora's Mask.
I also want to point out that somebody was mentioning how beautiful it is when the full Ballad of the Windfish is playing with all eight of the instruments that you got. Yeah, that is like really amazing, and it meant basically that playing Link's Awakening with headphones was mandatory for me.
It was a real payoff for what you've been doing for dozens of hours.
So here's a great letter from Ronnie Martinson. By 1999, I started working in a games retailer, and in the Windows 3.x logistics system, someone had entered as a comment on this item, as essential as batteries. I still work in retail, and I've never seen a better description since.
Wow. That's great.
I would agree if you're a Game Boy owner, you should play this game.
I would contend that it's the best Game Boy game, period. And so if you have a Game Boy, you should own it.
That's a tough one.
I mean, Game Boy has many, many amazing games, but when I think of the Game Boy, like that is certainly one of the first that comes to mind.
And finally, the last letter I'll read is from Jay Eubanks. Link's Awakening probably isn't the best Zelda game, but it's my sentimental favorite. I got it along with two other Game Boy games for my 13th birthday. The games were a gift from my dad, who I later learned had narrowed it down to either three Game Boy games or a Virtual Boy, and ultimately he deferred to my brother's judgment. Good call, little brother.
Yeah,
that's good.
I hadn't played many RPGs or adventure games to that point, so Link's Awakening was the first time I really got attached to a game world. And when I beat it and watched the island fade away, it was the first time a game made me cry. To me, they'll always be Marin and Terran, not Malin and Talon. I've beaten Link's Awakening more times than any other Zelda before or since. And the only reason I don't cry now when I beat it is because I'm on my guard and I catch myself.
You know, these letters really speak to how much Link's Awakening means to people. Mm. And, you know, like game rankings are kind of arbitrary, but like Kotaku called it like number 2 on their rankings. US Gamer called it number 5. And it really speaks to the quality of this game.
All Zelda games.
It stands up with these games that are remembered as the best, like pretty much ever made. Like people don't think, oh, and there was also the Game Boy one and it was pretty limited. No, they're thinking like, no, Link's Awakening, like as I said earlier, stands right up there with Link to the Past and even an Ocarina of Time because they pushed that system to the max. The puzzles were so intricate and the story so emotional.
Link's Awakening, unlike the other Zelda games that tend to be canonized of the very top, didn't create a new genre or define how the genre works. I mean, you look at The Legend of Zelda, that that basically created the top-down action RPG. You look at A Link to the Past, and that is how basically action RPGs work now. Like the idea of, you know, these items that you collect and the using these things to kind of break through bosses, defenses, and so forth. Ocarina of Time said this is how these games should work in 3D. Link's Awakening didn't do any of that, but it's just such a well-crafted game. There's so much heart and so much just genuine – there's so much of the creators in it that, you know, it really does stand apart as something special. You don't have to create or revolutionize video gaming in order to create a masterpiece. And this is a great example of that.
I totally agree. It's telling that I think actually the no portable Zelda to this point has actually managed to surpass it.
I really like Link Between Worlds.
I want to say Link Between Worlds is amazing, but it owes such a huge debt to Link to the Past.
True.
Where Link's Awakening is its whole thing.
It has some flaws too, much more so than Link's Awakening.
I have some interesting trivia, which I find interesting, which I actually didn't know the Japanese name of this game, and it took me like 5 wiki searches to find it. But apparently the subtitle is Yume Omirushima, which means Dreaming Island, which that's a pretty good adaptation.
Yeah, it kind of gives away the story. Right there.
Yes. Yeah. Dreaming Island.
Wow, the Link's Awakening also does.
Yeah. Well, not immediately.
I mean, he wakes up in the first minutes.
The beginning of the game. Oh, there he woke up. Okay, game's over.
And there are also 2 instances of censorship for some pretty racy jokes. And I want to point them out because they're funny that they would be in a Zelda game. So when you go to Animal Village, there is a painter painting a hippo. And in the Japanese version, before you walk in or before you walk up to her, she's holding a towel down and her giant bosoms are exposed. But then when you walk up to her, she pulls the towel up. So apparently the artist is painting her nude. And in the Japanese version, in the mermaid quest, you have to find her pearl necklace, which is also disgusting. But in the Japanese version, you have to find her top. Mm-hmm. And she says in the Japanese version, the translation is, when I was swimming in the bay, the waves swept away my swimsuit. If you find it, I'll give you my censored. So who knows what's going on there?
Ooh, sounds like a puff puff.
I mean, it is Link's dream, so.
Yeah, and, and if you dive
he's
near,
a growing boy.
Link's really into hippopotamus ladies, you know.
He's a 16-year-old.
He's drawing a lot of good fan art at that age.
And also, if you dive near the mermaid when you're looking for her top, in Japanese she calls you a pervert, and in English she just says, I've already looked around here. So there you go.
Wow.
So there are some racy boob jokes in Link's Awakening, which is why it's my lock of the Zelda week.
All right. So I think that wraps it up. That's a heck of an episode.
It's a spicy meatball.
Thanks to everyone who wrote in about the game. Sorry if I didn't get to read your letter. There were a lot to work through.
But let's say next time 150 words.
Yeah,
maybe.
Yeah.
I appreciate the passion. I have written way too long letters to podcasts and they never get read.
It's okay.
So.
I can edit.
Here's curate. The thing is that I love reading them just as like somebody
as, like,
who's
comments.
Posting them. Yeah, but then you got to cut them down.
Yeah, there were a few of these that were like people's life stories, and I couldn't read that all.
I was born.
But thanks, everyone, for sharing your enthusiasm for the game. Anyway, this has been a great episode of Retronauts about a great game.
Mm-hmm.
Thanks for listening. And let's go through the table and see who's who.
As I awaken from this dream, I'm ready to tell you that I'm HENEREYG on Twitter. Follow me there for all my information and musings on the world of today. And also, you can find my written work about video games on fandom.com. And more importantly, you can also listen to me and Bob, a podcast away on Talking Simpsons, the podcast where we go through every episode of The Simpsons from the beginning, one episode at a time. We just had a landmark episode with one of the writers on the series, Bill Oakley. It's always fun and is part of the Laser Time Network. And you can also support that through the Patreon of patreon.com/lasertime. TalkingSimpsons.com. Check it out.
Kat?
Hi, I'm Kat Bailey. You can follow me on Twitter at @_KatPod. I am the host of RPG podcast Acts of the Blood God, along with my co-host Nadia Oxford. And by the time you listen to this episode, we should be on episode 100, which is quite
– wow, way to go.
Well done.
Quite the milestone for Acts of the Blood God.
Call me when you get to 300, Kat. Well, so we're I'm kidding.
Are you not affiliating yourself with the US Gamer?
Well, we're still a growing podcast. And I also wanted to say that I run a little website called US Gamer. And if you are a fan of Retronauts, well, you should come check us out because I think that we are all retro-sensitive, I suppose. Like we have a good...
retro-sensitive.
We have a good perspective on history. Nadia, in particular, really loves writing about game history. So, yeah, come on by. Like you're going to... You'll never see us slagging on handhelds or anything.
Hi, it's Bob. You can find me on Twitter as Bob Servo. Henry has already talked about Talking Simpsons, but I must reiterate, you must listen to it. It's so good. Kat, please give us your endorsement of Talking Simpsons live on the air.
Holy crap. Talking Simpsons is an amazing podcast.
I didn't think she'd actually do it. Wow.
I don't know. I really love it. Bob and Henry and Chris and all of them are hilarious. Like, they do a great job of capturing the spirit of the show, and they are so knowledgeable. Please listen to Talking Simpsons.
It's almost embarrassing how much we've devoted our lives to knowing things about The Simpsons. God. So, yes, find me on Twitter as Bob Servo. I also write for fandom.com alongside Henry, and I write for somethingawful.com every other Thursday, a new comedy article, and that's it for me.
And finally, I, Jeremy Parrish, will knock you all down unless you come to retronauts.com and read the site. And of course, download the show through iTunes or your other choices. I think you can get it directly from Podcast One now. We are, of course, supported through Patreon at patreon.com/retronauts. And there's no GH in that. It's just like astronaut, but with retro, you know, old astronauts. That's basically it. We're also ad supported, as you've noticed. But if you subscribe to us through Patreon, $3 a month gets you a 1 week early access to each episode and also an ad free version. So if you're one of those people who's like, stupid advertisements, how dare people support their existence by making me listen to ads in their free things? Well, if you don't want it to be annoying, you can always pay a little bit of money and get the annoyance out. So
I give $6 a month.
My goodness.
Thank you. And I want to tell people, this is not just us showing up and talking about stuff on the top of our heads. We do a lot of work beforehand. Yeah. Jeremy's squinting at me.
No. It's not a squint. It's a look of exhaustion.
This is not a guilt trip. I just spent the last 20 hours of work after work all last week doing research.
In between your full-time job.
Your daddy works hard for you kids. Your podcast daddy.
Plus, you know,
it also pays for the site and other things.
Yeah. Yeah.
So, for us to go out and do live events this year. So, yes, thanks for your support. It's really cool. Also, you can follow me on Twitter as GameSpite. I'm not actually that spiteful. The guy who created the Lego Dimensions disagrees, but he's a minority of one. Everyone else thinks I'm lovable and cuddly. So
did you
follow
debate
me.
Him yet?
I didn't.
Okay, never
I just
that.
I muted him.
Good.
Anyway. So that wraps it up for this fine episode of Retronauts. Thanks again for listening. Thanks again for supporting us. We'll be back next week with probably a Retronauts radio is my guess. So look forward to it.
Your yard takes a real beating from the constant wear and tear and overcrowding of weeds leading to weak, thin grass. Achieve the lawn of your dreams by starting the Scotts Turf Builder Program. Keep it simple. With four simple feedings throughout the year, your grass will be thicker, greener, and more resilient. A greener, stronger lawn fights against common problems like weeds and bugs. It also stands up versus heat, drought, and wear and tear. And with Scott's no-quibble money-back guarantee, if you're not satisfied, you'll get your money back. So take control and give your lawn the boost it deserves. Start your Scott's Turf Builder program today. This is a Scott's Yard.
The Mueller Report. I'm Ed Donahue with an AP News Minute. President Trump was asked at the White House if Special Counsel Robert Mueller's Russia investigation report should be released next week when he will be out of town.
I guess from what I understand, that will be totally up to the Attorney General.
Maine's Susan Collins says she would vote for a congressional resolution disapproving of President Trump's emergency declaration to build a border wall, becoming the first Republican senator to publicly back it. In New York, the wounded supervisor of a police detective killed by friendly fire was among the mourners attending his funeral. Detective Brian Simonson was killed as officers started shooting at a robbery suspect last week. Commissioner James O'Neill was among the speakers today at Simonson's funeral.
It's a tremendous weight to bear, knowing that your choices will directly affect the lives of others. But cops like Brian don't shy away from it. It's the very foundation of who they are and what they do.
The robbery suspect and a man police say acted as his lookout have been charged with murder. I'm Ed Donahue.